grab your credential. It's time to go inside Press Row with Jordan Breen on the SureDog.com blog.
Welcome inside Press Row. I'm Jordan Breen. With back-to-back 10 decision cards, it goes without saying, fans aren't particularly high on the UFC's product and the overall MMA climate right now. But it's not just fight quality that's got some folks bristling. MMA, it's events, it's fighters, it's fights. They used to seem unique, special, distinct. Now, once hungry MMA fans are bellyaching over what they see as a homogenous product in some cases. So here to discuss the potential lack of flavor and spice in the current UFC recipe, an undeniably zesty man, the editor and poobah hornwear of BloodyElbow.com, Mr. Kid Nate Wilcox. Kid, how do you feel about the UFC's kitchen right now, Nate? Like, what's going wrong? What's going awry? How could it be tastier for you?
Well, you know, I'm actually here not to bury Caesar, but to praise him, because I think the UFC has a plan. I think that they're executing it deliberately, and I think that there is a logic behind the plan. I don't know that the logic will work. I mean, I don't know if the logic makes sense, and I don't know if the plan works, but I think, and, you know, uninformed speculation about other people's motivations is not just my specialty. It's a compulsion I have, so I can't be stopped from saying this no matter what.
You got to do what you love.
Yeah, you do. And you know, it doesn't matter what the Bleacher Report's do's and don'ts are, because I don't work for Bleacher Report. So anyway, I think that the UFC is out to genericize and normalize the product. They're trying to take the freak show right on out of MMA and just make it part of the American, the North Americans, the worldwide sports menu. And the approach they have taken is to suck all the life and fun out of it. And then so far, so good.
See, that seems to me like the totally wrong road. Do you really think there's an active thought of if we normalize this product, it'll be beneficial to us?
I do. Well, I mean, I think mostly it's an obsessive drive for control, which is not really exceptional. A lot of people are really down on Zuffa, but I don't even think that they're particularly bad actors in terms of the modern business climate. I mean, compared to, say, J.P. Morgan or Citibank or the Koch brothers or whoever, you know, McDonald's, pick a corporation, and Zuffa is going to come out. I mean, unless it's Costco or somebody that's made part of their brand distinction being, you know, bleeding heart liberal, whiny-ass, you know, suck-ups, you know, every corporation out there is a bunch of money-hungry, greedy, relentless, brutal monsters. And Zuffa's just a little guy in there trying to compete with the big dogs. And so, yeah, I don't know that it's a deliberate plan, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was. I think they're pretty smart guys, and I think that they have a long-term vision and a short-term vision, and I think that they do want to make the sport more – I mean, you know, definitely I think that – like the thing with the sponsors and the whole UFC uniform idea, I really do think that Dana and the Fertittas are upset, and Joe Silva and whoever, when they see a guy in the octagon with a – big old Condom Depot sign on his ass.
But they really haven't allowed, like, Condom Depot is now the, that's the territory of Bellator and so forth. That's where Condom Depot pops up. Now, do you really think they bristle seeing guys in Nike or Bad Boy or something like that to the point that they need to have an Under Armour generified uniform?
I think that they probably are in talks with some companies that are making them some very attractive offers.
It's Under Armour. If they do this uniform thing, it's going to be Under Armour.
And that's a pretty legit company. That's a company with money, and that's a company that will probably pay handsomely. And the UFC then can then divvy it up with their fighters. It's going to be worse for some fighters who had – for the handful of fighters who had big enough sponsors who could actually pay the sponsor tax.
There's going to be an opt-out clause for this, though, right? Like, a guy like John Jones, he can't just be like, all right, I'll show up in these Under Armour shorts and put a swoosh on them.
You really think there'll be an opt-out clause?
I think there's got to be an opt-out clause, at least for some guys. You can't the one situation that the UFC can never, ever court, shout-outs to the UFC, UFC 151 debacle. Is that what number that shit
was? That was a disaster.
Shout out to that debacle. You can never incite the wrath of the guys that are actually powerful enough to, if not mutiny, then at least destroy a large part of your ship. Can't be tussling with your Anderson Silvas and George St. Pierre's and John Jones.
Well, they don't have any. They're already tussling with GSP. They don't have Anderson anymore. Rampage and his Reebok deal are gone.
More reason not to step on the toes of the guys who get to wear the swoosh at this point in time.
Who's left that's a Nike client for him?
Well, I guess technically Anderson Silva still is going to fight for them at some point in the future, and John Jones.
Oh, is Dos Santos still a Nike guy?
I believe so. So if he rolls up in Brazil, he might not be too happy about throwing on the Under Armour gear and having to put a swoosh over as well. Some guys, it suits very nicely. I mean, like a Demetrius Johnson, a little Under Armour short, put a big Xbox logo on there, you're set. Off to the races. But for guys that actually have apparel deals, yeah, pretty sketch.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think – I mean, and is there any allowance in the UFC contracts for the apparel deals? I mean, or is that just something that's de jure allowed or de facto allowed but isn't actually specified in the contract?
Yeah, I mean, at this point in time, the UFC still operates with bro deals. I mean, you look at like the Uriah Faber situation, him coming in and fighting Hayden Barrow, and part of the whole shebang and him stepping in on late notice and then not pulling out of the fight with a busted hamstring was the fact that Dana White was willing to wear Torque gear all week and shit like that. And he was allowed to relentlessly push the product that he's associated with. So there's some guys that are clever enough to work out those kind of handshake deals and get to like push their products. I don't imagine if the UFC is able to execute their uniform deal that everybody's going to be happy. I think some guys have to then get it in writing that they can work around that somehow, because some guys have real ironclad kind of stuff that they have to do that might not jive with that. The UFC can't impose on absolutely everybody in that way without a little bit of blowback in some cases.
Well, we've already seen some blowback from one UFC titan, strawweight Felice Herrig, who's due to make her UFC debut on the next season of The Ultimate Fighter. I think when she fired that shot across the bow on Instagram, I'm sure Lorenzo Fertitta woke up in a cold sweat.
Well, Under Armour can make her some gladiator shorts, I'm sure.
That I have no doubt. I have no doubt. But you know, for many Felice fans, it's the variety. And I think she likes the variety too. I mean, of uniforms, of, you know, changing her look, changing her outfit. And
well,
I mean,
also
do you think
say that the choice of the word uniform is particularly terrible. If Dana White had come out and said that they were angling to make like UFC fight apparel and make, you know, kind of more, maybe use the word standard or something like that, but saying uniform, like it makes it sound like the Hunger Games or something. It's absolutely atrocious. It creates this image that my first image when I heard Dana White say it is I thought, oh, I assume he's talking about them being in talks with Under Armour, but it sounds an awful lot like he's describing them dressing up in Star Trek pinnies or something like that. Little insignias on the chest. It sounds awful.
Yeah, it does. And it sounds like exactly the sort of thing that you know, many fans complain is wringing the life and the fun right out of the sport. You know, I don't know if you just saw Nate Quarry go off on the UFC on the Underground last night, but I mean, coming out and saying the UFC does not care about fighters, and particularly he hit on the sponsor grind and how things changed from the time he was in the UFC to the end of his career and what it's like now, you know, and once upon a time, fighters really, not only could they make some serious extra money from sponsors on the side, but they also got a lot of promotion and they got to promote their own personality through YouTube videos and things they worked on and ads they did with their sponsors. And now not only, you know, has the MMA apparel market, you know, done the whole classic organisms overpopulating their environment and then having a population crash thing. I mean, nobody wants to.
Well, dude, put it this way. If we're using ecosystem and biology-based metaphors, there's at least a safe habitat for MMA apparel. There's sanctuaries. There's Marshalls. There's TJ Maxx. There's Ross. There's Winners. There's all of those stores that you can just look at rack on rack on rack of Head Rush t-shirts.
It's true. And are those selling and are people wearing them? I mean, you know, it went from Affliction t-shirts being chic, which was a really weird and dark, awful period for me, right up there with those fat pants girls were wearing that went below their waist with the high t-shirt. So you take a curvy 20-something girl and make it focus on the back fat, which is not really what men are evolved to zero in on. Anyway, but there was this hideous brotastic fashion plague of MMA goons that was everywhere, and that has crashed and burned. I don't know if – I mean, people might be buying shit at TJ Maxx, but that's probably to put their developmentally disabled brother-in-law in because they don't want to spend any money on other clothes for him.
Woof. That is a rough sentiment to cast.
Am I wrong? Am I wrong?
MMA fans, in some cases, especially that class of MMA citizen, are ne'er-do-wells. Who am I to say this is an accurate stereotype? Who am I?
I mean, I gotta say, I've got some cool MMA apparel that I'll happily wear. It just doesn't have wings and skulls and shit on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still cool things you can do with MMA apparel, and guys are getting the Reebok deals and the Nike deals and such like. But anyway, that's a side point. But the bigger point is, you know, the UFC is definitely putting the fighters and the product through a meat grinder and just coming out with this pink stuff paste that looks like something, you know, that Burger King would be squeezing into McNuggets.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember, too, is one of the things that sucks is I get why the UFC wants sponsor control to some extent because, as you mentioned, like no one wants to mess with the condom depots of the world if you're trying to legitimize yourself on network television as a mainstream sport. I get that. But if you look at the past in MMA when it comes to creating personalities and personas for people or really hammering it home, there is legitimate crossover with like clothing and brands and that kind of stuff. Look at the Korean Zombie shirt and how fast it caught on.
Sure.
Tri-Costa ended up having problems and people complained that they weren't paying fighters or whatever. But if Tri-Costa didn't get a foot in the door to make that shirt, who knows how people would feel about the Korean Zombie as MMA's cult hero darling year to year.
It's true, but it seems like the UFC doesn't care about things like that. I mean, if they're willing to let Gilbert Melendez walk, and the jury's still out on that, we don't know if they're going to make him a counteroffer and try to match what Bellator and Viacom are throwing at him or not. But it seems to me there's a pretty clear message of, if you're not Ronda Rousey, we don't care. Like, hit the
brakes.
And
see, this is why I don't think it can be any kind of willful thing. Like, I believe that there could be a whole series of decisions being made, like the uniform thing and like, say, the accelerated schedule and them wanting to ambitiously expand internationally at a time when they already owe Fox so many cards and that kind of thing. I think all of these things taken together create a climate where all of these things are true. The UFC product, it gets watered down in a very easy metaphorical sense. It gets turned into a pink, grayish, pasty gruel, which ends up with 10-plus decisions on a particular card with guys that you should be watching on regional circuits. And in many cases, not even the main event of those particular regional circuits. But I don't think that's a willful thing because the UFC, if they need anything, if you ask people from the PR department all the way up to the shiniest of the brass, they'll tell you we need stars. We need people that can sell on pay-per-view. We need Ronda Rousey, Jon Jones. We could really use a new Brock Lesnar or a GSP or something like that.
So are they really that inept at star making? I mean, they're sitting there saying they want stars and then actively doing everything they can to not develop them.
I think some of the stuff are like some of the things are bad decisions, like the sponsor thing, where they're very granular decisions and they definitely don't suit the development of a star. However, I think some of the things are they operate on a more insidious, systematic type level that kind of goes unseen. Like the sheer fact that there's bazillions and dozens of cards now, it's harder to care about any one individual thing. Like going back to the sponsor thing, it shows kind of the interconnectedness of it. One of the reasons, in addition to the fact that just MMA is less in vogue now, is like a cool, oh, gotta see it, everyone's eyeballs are going to be on every event. Part of it is just that there are so many events. If you were any kind of company, you'd probably be more fired or jazzed up to fire, or, you know, sponsor a fighter for a UFC card if you knew that there was only like one a month and more people would be watching, or if you knew that it wasn't like a tripartite distribution platform and, uh-oh, is this dude that I'm sponsoring going to end up on Fight Pass or some shit like that? If it was more streamlined the way it used to be, there would be probably richer sponsorship opportunities, if not for everybody, then for some particular individuals who happen to find some pretty good sponsors that suit their persona. You still get some really nice synergies. Like I mentioned Demetrius Johnson and Xbox. I think that's one of the easiest ones. Got a good, polished, exciting, entertaining champ who's a good ambassador for the sport, who happens to really only give a shit about MMA and video games, and Xbox is his sponsor and really his only sponsor. That's how it's supposed to work. But I think more guys would have the opportunity for that kind of link up and that kind of synergy if it was a yesteryear sort of setup. If it was not even like 12 events, even if we were like on a 24 event schedule, I think sponsors would kind of feel better about
what are we currently on, about a 65 event a year schedule? Or
this year we're probably at between 50 and 60 probably.
Jesus Christ, that is so insane. And how many of those events are North American fans supposed to care about, and how many of those are going to be, you know, international Fight Pass specials?
Well, yeah, and this is the problem now, is if you're a UFC roster guy, if you're not if you're not someone who's really calling your own shots for the most part, and that's a very, very select group of 450, that's a very elite cabal of homies at the very upper echelons hanging out in wingback chairs smoking cigars next to taxiderm bears. Outside of that group, you could end up on any card at any time. So if you were down, if you've had some sponsor since, you know, you were in the regional circuit or whatever, and you go to the UFC, and even if they're an approved sponsor, you might get erratic. Like if you're actually looking at it from a business perspective, what are you getting out of a fighter if maybe he's on a main card of one of the big four Vegas pay-per-views, and then all of a sudden he's on the next card, you know, an undercard in Sweden?
Yeah, I mean it's a brutal whiplash there, and you look at somebody like Alexander Gustafsson, who's exactly the case study you're talking about. I mean, this is a guy who went from headlining against John Jones in the best fight of the most compelling fight of John Jones's career, and his next fight is what, on a Fight Pass card coming out of London?
Yeah, I mean, or you know,
look or is at, it on is that on Fox Sports 1, or is the headliner of that, is that strictly Fight Pass?
I believe the actual like meat and potatoes portion is on FS1.
Okay, but still, it's that blows. What are they averaging on FS1 these days? 200,000, 300,000,
something in that ballpark. I'd have to double check real quick.
Which is such a plunge from the million to 2 million plus that they used to get on Spike. I mean, what was it? How many people watched Rampage versus Hendo? Was that like 6-7 million?
I want to say that got up to like 4.5 or something like that.
4.5 million. I mean, you know, it was Tito and Ken 3 that got 6 or 7
yes.
million. I mean,
yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, to me, it's either a deliberate strategy because they realized that the fad was going to come to an end, which was obvious. I mean, that's what fads do. And they saw what had just happened in Japan, and they've seen the history of the sport in Brazil, I would hope. And that they deliberately – they got the Fox deal, that was their whole game plan. Let's get with a big network partner so we can ride out the off years. And now they're there with Fox. They feel like, look, our product's going to be part of the American sports landscape for the next 5 years now, 7 when they first signed the deal. We're here to stay. We can ride this out. And in the meantime, we can dramatically expand over the globe and work out these kinks, that they realize there's going to be some things that go wrong while that's happening, and we'll deal with that when the time comes. That's, to me, otherwise, it's just this blind sort of sucking the product dry without realizing that there's actually, a limited number of MMA fighters that are of a caliber to carry a major league sport, and B, a limited amount of interest in combat sports in general and MMA in particular.
There's many masters afoot now. It used to be, though, that Zuffa wanted to make money while providing an MMA product. Now you have a television deal. I mean, we can harp on what it's like, FS1, whatever. The UFC 169 prelims, I believe, did just under a million. I think like 930 million or 930,000 or something like that, which is pretty darn strong for FS1. Like, when you look at FS1's ratings, like, the UFC shoulder bullshit best of UFC main event package unleashed whatever the hell of the week, that is, like, that's the glue that they have at this point in time. They're doing 200,000 people tuning in to watch garbage auxiliary UFC programming. For a fledgling cable network, they got to be ecstatic with what the UFC has helped them do so far, even though when an MMA fan looks at it, it's like, oh, my God, more of this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's a very real thing. That Fox relationship is important. Fox is a major power player, not just in the media landscape, but in the sports landscape in North America and around the world. And you can't underestimate the importance of keeping Fox happy. So they've got to serve two masters. So that explains part of watering down the product. But, you know, they've never been very good at building stars. I mean, if you look at the stars that have emerged in the Zuffa era.
Okay, real quick, though. This is something we need to address quickly. How easy do you think it is to build stars? Because if you even look at something like
Pride certainly made it look easy.
Pride made it look easy, but Pride also had a lot of things going for it. Pride, in many cases, inherited people that already had either Olympic pedigrees, which are inherently cared about in a different way in that Japanese industry, inheriting people with rich pro wrestling backgrounds, inheriting people that were already famous through K1 in some cases. They definitely made stars in some cases, but they inherited a lot of guys already with star power, which kind of...
Well, I wouldn't say they inherited guys so much as they opportunistically signed behind guys who already had star power.
But they, saying that Pride was good at making stars to some extent, like saying the UFC is good at making stars because they got Brock Lesnar.
No, it's a different thing because the Pride could take somebody like Wanderlei Silva, who before the Pride era, I mean, admittedly, had a big rep with the hardcore, the very small pool of worldwide hardcore MMA fans who were passing VHS tapes around.
Like Wanderlei, though, in the UFC, guys like Wanderlei still become stars. Wanderlei was a pound-for-pound elite fighter with tons of natural just charisma and personality. He instantly grabbed Brazilian fans. He instantly grabbed Japanese fans.
He brought that aura over from Pride and the way they did it with the intros. I mean, who was the idiot boxer, pro wrestler with the mask that Krokop knocked out? Dos Caras Jr. Look, they made that guy a star in a 15-minute promo. I mean, like when that tape came in, I remember getting it and going, what is this shit? I got to see it. You know, I mean, they sold that. I was like, oh, my God, this guy is a Mexican pro wrestler and he's going to wear a mask in the ring against Krokop. I got to see this. And I never forgot that. I mean, I forgot his name, but, you know, that guy sticks with me. And had he had any fighting ability at all, you know, they could have done a lot more with him. I'm just saying the UFC, the only stars they've really made organically within the organization are GSP and John Jones. Everybody else was already a big star, a champion.
Anderson Silva was a big star.
Anderson Silva wasn't a big star, but it took them – Anderson Silva didn't become a big star until Charles Sonnen made him a big star, circumstances. I mean, it –
he drew a huge number with Vitor Belfort too.
That was after Charles Sonnen.
But really, you just think like, oh, he had the one fight with Chael and it's
no,
off
No, I think that, A, he was the greatest fighter of our era.
But my point is this. These are guys that won for a long time. Wanderlei did the exact same thing.
Sure. I mean, those guys are going to break through, but
great,
look at how –
Great people with charisma make it on their own. To me
– Anderson Silva doesn't have that much – I mean, he has charisma in a way, but he also has a bit of anti-charisma, especially –
No doubt. But you would never argue that Anderson is – I completely agree with the anti-charisma. Anderson is a unique charismatic enigma, but I would say the charisma still wins out over the anti-charisma.
In the end, yes, in the context of his career, but that was a big part of why it took them so long to get him over with American fans, and I don't even think they got him over with American fans. Chael Sonnen got himself over with American fans and then put on such a great fight that allowed Anderson Silva to show just how great he was in coming back to beat Chael, and that is what got him over.
Even though it's a self-directed prerogative on Chael's part, Chael, to me, or guys like Chael, are more indicative of a real star-making potential process because these are guys that wouldn't have necessarily been on them. Forrest Griffin is more indicative of star-making process because that's a guy that wouldn't have ever amounted to being that guy without manicuring.
Forrest is an exception. Okay, you got me there. Forrest is the one exception to the GSP John Jones thing that they've made a star. And that whole era of tough guys, the coaches, Chuck Liddell, Randy Couture, you know, Tito was a star before that, basically the only star they had, Tito and Ken Shamrock, but they took their stardom to a new level with the Ultimate Fighter show. I mean, for a while their formula worked. They had the reality show, they had the pay-per-views, they had the DVD packages, and I think people forget how key those DVDs being everywhere and being pretty cheap and being really good. I mean, I remember, you know, when the UFC got back on cable and got back on pay-per-view, and then how happy I was to see DVDs for sale at Blockbuster, and I picked up a few of them. Yeah, you know, probably to rent and then
Well,
and
think
then
about what
later.
DVDs represent. I mean, that represents a time where you would want to sit down and pop in some fights. Because you couldn't go find them. I'm like,
exactly.
Why would you buy a UFC DVD now? You're like, oh, dude, we can just wait till Thursday. There's a card on TV.
Yeah, and you're going to see any fight you're thinking, oh, man, I'd like to see that again. It's probably going to be either on Fight Pass or UFC Unleashed at some point soon or whatever Fox Sports
is already on the internet if you know how to use Google.
Sure, sure. And so, you know, that's not entirely their fault. But also, if you look at who was on those cards, you know, take a UFC anywhere in the 40s or 50s, and you might see somebody like Nick Diaz or Carol Parisian on the undercard. And those were guys who just shined and popped with personality because their fighting style was unique, their personas were unique. You know, even just in a five-minute preview, you could tell that Nick Diaz was somebody very interesting. And the same thing with Carol Parisian. And the guys now, they don't even get the promos to tell their story. I mean, like on the fights the other night, you didn't even get to see him walk into the cage. It was literally just fight after fight after fight. I mean, it's like even the porno industry knows you want to see a girl. You want to see the girl or guy.
How old are you? Where are you from?
What's your exactly.
Favorite, what's your favorite position? When was the first time you gave a guy a blowjob?
Cody, yeah. Have you ever done gay for pay before? All right. Now we're in for a treat. Now, so that's the deal. And so, you know, I mean, even porno knows that. Like, the meat grinder has a limited appeal and an appeal that wears – that, you know, lessens the appeal of the performers that are involved. And I don't know if they know that that's what they're doing. But that sure as shit is like the fight Saturday. Looking back over that wave of seven decisions, four or five, maybe three or four of those fights, those were good, fun fights. I mean, that Wilson Heist Alcantara fight, that was one of the better grappling matches with some really fun scrambles that we've gotten to see in MMA in a while. And yet, because of the context, I'm never going to want to go back and see, well, what was the deal with that half sweep? Or, you know, like, you just don't care anymore. You can't pick out the fights. They're just lost in the sea of bleh, and it's killing me, Smalls. And here's a question for you. Why are these fights going to decision? Because I don't remember watching jungle fights and seeing an endless succession of decisions, and yet you take the same guys. You probably just take jungle fights, turnkey it, and boom, it's a UFC card, and now it's suddenly decisions. What is the deal?
I would say that some of it comes down to the individual matchmaking, but also, like, I think there's a whole confluence of things that happen. Like, sometimes it's an injury situation. You get a guy who steps in on short notice and just maybe isn't ready. But also just the fact that once you get into that, like, I'm one of the 60 best guys in my division, 50 best guys in my division, the kind of like standard deviations between dudes, like, it's just more and more generic guys that don't necessarily have major knockout power, dynamic submission ability, or elite wrestling. They don't really have the things that set them apart. They might just be really good roster fighters. And when you get really good roster fighters matched up against one another, oftentimes you get 15-minute decisions. I mean, that's
another thing that Pride knew how to do and Strikeforce knew how to do is set up mismatches. Feed some cans to your killers. And even your mid-level guys, if you can toss a guy in against somebody who's significantly better than him, they did it for Eric Silva this weekend.
Which was a late replacement fight.
Well, sure, but the guy that he was probably better than the guy that he was replacing.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, the objective clearly was to give both Oliveira and Silva squash matches. Oliveira had a little more struggle with Ogle than they expected, but it's like, let's do squash matches. There's nothing wrong with squash matches. A, it's more fun for the fans to see a beating, and those can sometimes turn into upsets.
Or, oh, yeah. You know. You get a guy who comes out on charge that night, that guy can make his career. Give
exactly.
That man a chance.
Like Chad Griggs or whatever against Bobby Lashley. And so, you know, it makes for a better entertainment product. And B, you don't find yourself in the position of having an Eric Silva who's now hitting the peak of his athletic years without ever having become a UFC star, and he's been on the roster for 3 years. Like, they signed him as a really hot smoking prospect that's highly touted by his camp, that people are saying this guy's a future champion. And I don't know, you know, if he is or if he isn't a future champion, but the reality is if you manage his career right, he could have been four impressive, exciting fights in and had a title shot.
Well, from Eric Silva shows off. It shows off how little room there is for error, though, because the thing is, like, most people still see Eric Silva as a prospect, whether or not he is a future title contender or not.
He's yet, too old.
There isn't that buzz, though, and one of the reasons is simply the fact that
they threw him in against John Fitch.
But, well, even if you lose to guys like Fitch or Donghyun Kim, who were decent welterweights and whatnot, you lose in the UFC and just kind of end up in the pack. Like, it's a long-ass pack if you're in division like 155, 170. The capacity to get forgotten about is enormous.
Absolutely, absolutely. But they don't help any by booking a guy like Silva I mean, you know, two fights in or three fights in, whatever it was, and they throw him against John Fitch, who at the time was this merciless grinder. I don't know what they were thinking. I mean,
Maybe we'll get rid of John Fitch.
Why not just book John Fitch, you know, on short notice like Pride would have done? You know, I mean, there are ways to fuck with fighters that don't water down your product. And
Here's the thing, though, is this is all, again, like, this is why I think it's such a prickly, thorny situation. It is all – there's an interconnectedness to it all, because we would have a better shot at making all of these guys more interesting on a fight-by-fight basis if, as you said, we got the generic black and white, Carl Parisian, do you even know who I am, bro, kind of promos, going to put the heat on him, throw him on his head, whatever. Even if we got 15, 20 seconds of that, maybe we get just enough zazz and personality to shine through, makes us care about a prelim, as opposed to just having to go through them at warp speed with Bruce Buffer doing the Micro Machines voice because every fight's going overtime. Likewise, if we didn't have 3-4 events a month, we could do UFC primetimes and stuff that people used to. Do you remember when they did the first GSP Penn primetime? Like how just, just frothy people were?
Oh, yeah. People were lathered up and people were fighting with each other about whether or not BJ Penn was training enough. And, you know,
the final scenes of them landing in Vegas, BJ Penn running underwater with The Rock. So many iconic moments. We get none of that now. Those things cost like just over $1 million to produce per, you know, or not per episode, but per series, per run, if they do 3 or 4 of them. They don't have that kind of time, money, or resource to just invest.
And they also don't have a platform to show it.
I mean,
because nobody's going to tune into Fox Sports 1 to see it. Spike was in a position where they had an audience,
yeah,
and you could, and they didn't have a lot of other hot programming, and the UFC could put stuff on. One other side trail I want to go down is, how telling is it that the UFC's relationship with Spike ended so badly? I mean, is that, does that say something about Zuffa that they can't have a partnership for several years and move up in a totally logical business move and not have scorched earth? Because here's the point I want to make. Remember when Spike had that MMA Uncensored show?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that was nothing special, blah, 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 unless you were a Nate Corey or Luke Thomas addict. And there's probably, you know, 4 of them, and they're all related to Nate or Luke. But it was a fine show that drew what? Between 400,000 and 600,000 people a week. Do you know how much the UFC would pay right now to get 400,000 to 600,000 people a week tuning in to basically an advertisement for their product? And I mean, the stupidity from both ends of canceling that show, both on Spike's part, because it was a perfect way to legitimize their Bellator product by having a show that talks about UFC, 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 and then every once in a while slips in a Bellator guy just at the same level. Oh, here's Nate Diaz from the UFC, and up next, Michael Chandler from Bellator. And so it was dumb on their part to cancel that show. I mean, it was presumably cheap, and with the ratings, it was – I mean, the other shit they're showing on that network is not doing much better than that. And from the UFC's point, you know, doing everything they could to sabotage that show when they are dying for that level of cable exposure, because FX1 will not give it to them. I mean, the way FX1 punked the UFC and got that poop out of their litter box – is one of the hilarious media stories I would die to hear, because they didn't want any part of the UFC on their network and they got rid of it after a year. And part of the deal, the UFC, when they signed that deal, they thought they were going to have access to the FX audience, and they don't. And they would love to, even if they don't know it, they should be dying to get back on Spike TV with an MMA show. And to me, that kind of stupidity and failure to work together, I mean, I think that Spike and Bellator and the UFC could have a congenial rival relationship that would be good for everybody instead of a scorched earth relationship that's leaving everybody starving.
This is MMA. Now you're just talking nonsense. It's like you don't even know who's involved.
It's true. What do you mean? You talking about me or are you talking about the fans? Or I mean, are you saying that I don't know the personalities are too volatile to ever work together reasonably?
You think Dana White and Bjorn Remney are just going to be high-fiving and sharing Diet Cokes in feasible –
But I think that all the UFC had to do was not tell their fighters not to go on that show. You know, all they had to say is, hey, if y'all want to do MMA Uncensored, great. We're not going to like go out of our way to help you, but we're not going to like punish you for it either. And not talk shit about Spike TV all the time, you know? Like, that. How hard is that to do? And on Spike's side – Rebney didn't have to deal with the UFC. I mean, you know, it would be the show's bookers for MMA Uncensored dealing with the fighters and their management. And then you know, Bellator, of course, being the Spike product, should have the inside track to that show. And so Rebney's thing should be limited to, hey, I need some of my guys on the show, or I need this guy in that segment, not on that segment. You know, they shouldn't have to work together. They should just not step on their dicks and get in each other's way.
So real talk, Zuffa comes to you on the consulting tip. Nate Wilcox, look, we realize that we're serving out this slurry gruel, this pinkish-grayish paste. We got to zest it up. When they come to you after you come back with your big folio and all your research, what do the crib now tell me? What do these homies got to do to do this star-building process that you think is so easy that Pride actualized with such aplomb? What's the secret here? What are we lacking?
Man,
give us an easy fix, because we need an easy fix. There's no complicated one. We can't like get them a new TV deal. They're locked down with Fox forever. They're not going to start canceling events. So what is your patch to save the life raft? How are you saving this dinghy?
My short-term patch would be leagues, regional leagues with regional titles. Let somebody like Kawajiri have a shot at the Asian MMA, you know, the Asian UFC title. Let Michael Bisping have a shot at the Euro UFC title, or Gustafsson, whoever. You know, give those guys titles, make it clear that there's a circuit, and then once a year have an annual international tournament where those guys compete against each other and the winner gets a shot at the real UFC champion. Something like that. Like, let's draw some clear lines so fans know when, you know, what product they're watching. And yeah, I mean, because the choice is either have de facto tiers or have de jure tiers. They can either come out and say, hey, we've got a tiered product, or they can just have a tiered product, and that waters down the whole product. They need to have some events. They need to have some context. There needs to be a roadmap for fighters to succeed and fighters to break out of these morasses that are the Brazilian Fight Pass undercards. I mean, you know, because when you're watching these fights, like, there were three or four fighters on that Brazilian undercard this weekend that should be in the regular UFC sometime soon, that probably will get the short notice call to be the next Pat Cummins. And we need a way to know which of these guys should we pay attention to. That's what we need. And the fighters need to know, hey, I'm going to have the opportunity to make the real UFC stage and make real money and get real famous and not just be stuck. Like Kawajiri or somebody like that is just stuck. Next time the UFC decides to have an Asian card, maybe he'll get to fight. But what are the odds of Kawajiri getting on a U.S. card?
He hasn't liked flying, so it hurts. But I think they could do it. He just got to win fights. If you win and go, also he has a fight lined up. And as soon as I look at it real quick, you might actually be, doesn't he? Okay, Abu Dhabi, but
that's not.
He's getting to fight Clay Guida, though.
That is a relatively high-profile fight, and that is a step up, so that's something. But, you know, you've got these guys in this netherworld. Or somebody like Gustafsson that, you know, how much better can you do than fighting the UFC light heavyweight champ to a standstill, and your reward is to be on an FS1 card against a pretty dangerous guy nobody's ever heard of? That's just bunkum.
Well, if he wins, he'll probably get to do it again.
The good part. If he wins, that's, you know, that's something. But it doesn't do anything to build the Gustafsson property. You know, it's self defeating for the UFC and bad for Gustafsson. So, anyway, that's what I got.
Regional wrestling romantic and National Wrestling Alliance nostalgic Kid Nate Wilcox. Read the man over at bloodyelbow.com and follow this man zany harebrained ideas on Twitter at Kid Nate.
Candy, hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Nudge, elbow, punch, kick, step on somebody's laptop. Whatever you have to do to get a seat in Press Row. Wednesdays on the SureDog.com blog.